Welcome back to Fear or Favour, another fully packed 40 minutes or so. Nazir, how's your week been?
Busy as ever, but lovely. I mean, I must admit, I'm not going to criticise what I do. I do what I want to do. Everything I do, I enjoy doing. So just a lot of it. I wish I was about 30 years younger.
Yeah, no, I think that's the way, isn't it? And of course, you've got a very high profile now in the media, and that attracts work in a very positive way. And there are so many issues out there that fall under kind of like your experience. And, well, and it's great to have that balance so that you can
sometimes though, I do feel like an imposter though. I literally, the number of times, Mark, where somebody's come to me and said, Nazir, something has happened in the Seychelles and we'd like your comment on it. And I'm thinking, I don't know anything about this. Yeah. But, you know, Google is your friend. I always find that Google is my friend.
Yeah.
And I end up knowing a little bit more than I did 5 minutes before.
Yeah. It is a strange thing. I know over the years I've been asked to talk about things and I'm very clear. And I think, do you know what? If I don't have that experience, I haven't done it. I say, well, it's not really for me. Thanks very much. I think, you know, any of the stuff that I ever talk about, you know, I talk about it because I've got that experience, because I've done it.
Yeah, stick to
and
what
I
you
think
know.
It is so important to be able to do that. And often I watch and listen to interviews of other people, and you can always know those people who really don't know what they're talking about.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they don't answer the question. They answer the one they're prepared to answer because they've read up about it. You ask them a supplementary question, and their signal goes down, doesn't it? It's not like, something they want to talk about.
Bit like a politician.
Yeah, 100% like a politician.
So something that's come up really recently is the very sad death of Caroline Flack. Caroline Flack's mother has been in the media criticising really the approach of the Crown Prosecution Service, the DPP, and the Metropolitan Police in particular for bringing charges in relation to Caroline Flack. Sadly, Caroline Flack took her own life, and we now know the huge amount of mental health strain that she was under. It's all well and good being a celebrity and having that profile, but comes with that pressure, immense pressure in itself, because if you're a member of the public and you don't have that public profile, your life doesn't get played out in the media. And, you know, you and I, we both have a profile, and I've certainly experienced it over the years where, you know, people have had a go at me. I've had an article written in the papers about me. Totally unfair, but unfortunately, sadly, within the media circles, newspapers can effectively write whatever they want. They can have their own agenda. In television, it's very different in television and radio, where you really have to show balance and, you know, proper evidence around that. Newspapers,
absolutely.
Don't.
I think a lot of people confuse public interest with what's interesting to the public. There is no public interest in exploring somebody's mental health publicly. It might be interesting to the public, but there's no public interest in doing so. And of course, as we know from our own experiences and others as well, it can cause, re-traumatize somebody. It can cause real pain and ultimately lead to the terrible circumstances of death.
Karen Flack's situation was that there was an allegation made, the police turned up. And it was really very much the Metropolitan Police that decided that we should pursue the allegation and that it should go to court. The decision-making process, let's just go back, and we don't need to relate directly to Caroline Flack's position, but let's look at that. So a complaint comes in, the Metropolitan Police look at that complaint. There's a very clear guidance now in relation to dealing with domestic-type incidents where there doesn't need to be a complainant in respect of that.
Yeah, absolutely. They call it victimless prosecutions, which is a good thing in the main, because we know from experience that people who suffer domestic abuse will suffer a minimum of 35 incidents before they report, on average, before they report to the police. So once they have done, the police can look to see what other evidence there is to support the allegation. They don't have to rely upon what the complainant says. And I think that's what happened in Caroline Flack's case. He may have been reluctant. The alleged victim may have been reluctant, but they had, in their view, other evidence that supported an allegation against her.
And then, of course, the police will arrest, and they have a positive arrest strategy in relation to domestic assault. So they will arrest. They will then interview the individual. The officers then collect that information, that evidence, both sides, so it's as much looking for and against. Although one of the criticisms I've often applied to police investigations is that police investigations have to be about looking for the evidence, not about proving the offence. And those are two very different things. So if somebody comes in and makes an allegation and says, I've had something stolen, it's not for the police, it shouldn't be, and I've always been very critical of this, to then build up the evidence to show if something's stolen. What they should be looking at is to find out whether or not the circumstances around that. So, you know, was it put there in the first place? What is the background to all of that? So they should be investigating rather than simply looking to prove the offence.
Yeah, I call that tunnel vision. Too many officers and investigators have tunnel vision. They have a suspect, they have a less crime, and they look nowhere else. They don't look to around the sides to see whether or not there's anything that might undermine the case or anything that might support the case. They're completely and utterly focused on that suspect and that particular alleged crime. And that, I think, causes some substantial concerns for me.
And so we get to a position where the police will do their investigation, they'll collect the evidence. It used to be that you used to submit a file to the Crown Prosecution Service and wait for a response. Now there's very much a telephone conversation.
Yep.
And also to some degree, depending on how complex it is, a file that goes to the Crown Prosecution Service. Yep. They will then make their decision. Just to explain to our listeners how that CPS decision is made when that information comes to them.
Well, you mentioned the telephone service. CPS Direct is what it's called. It's not available to you, the public. It's only available to the police. So don't try and ring them up. They are experienced lawyers, and they will receive evidence electronically by email, statements, et cetera, potentially recordings or transcripts of interviews, et cetera, all of which will ultimately be their source. Now, what they then have to do is decide whether any of that amounts to a criminal offence, whether there's a realistic prospect of conviction. Is it more likely than not, on the basis of the evidence that we have or the evidence that we're promised, that a person can be convicted of a particular crime? And they also must look at what might undermine. Now, the reality, Mark, is that all has to be done in 45 minutes or thereabouts. And you know, and I know that can't happen. And so there will be occasions in which go away, carry on the investigation, come back, and they will come back with some more evidence, et cetera, et cetera. But the simple task is apply this document called the Code for Crown Prosecutors. It's published every year, republished every year, placed before Parliament every year, and it's the source of their judgment. But at the end of the day, it's still a judgment. Regardless of there's lots of guidance and lots of policy, but it's still a judgment. Is there enough evidence here against this person for that offence?
And whilst that works on one level, the CPS Direct, there is also a very close relationship, particularly when we're getting to major crime homicide teams, who will work very closely with a specialist CPS lawyer in giving that advice in relation to. So they will be over the media strategy, they will be over the arrest strategy, they'll be over that whole process. So there is a real relationship now that exists between the police and the CPS. And don't forget, going back many years, and I'm not sure whether it was in your time, the Crown Prosecution Service didn't exist and the police used to prosecute cases themselves.
Yeah, 1986, I wasn't born then, but in 1986 is when the Crown Prosecution Service was born. And before that, you had everything done by the police, and they instructed their own lawyers. The Royal Commission back in 1986 said, no, hang on, that can't be right. There needs to be an independent body that looks at the evidence. And so the CPS was born, and I joined it 3 or 4 years later. And it is a force for good. It's what modern civilized jurisdictions have. And it enables a gatekeeper, to somebody to look at the evidence. There are so many cases I dealt with, Mark, but the people know about, but there are so many cases they don't know about. The cases that I said to the police, there was not enough evidence. You don't tend to hear about those, and there are some very high profile cases of individuals that were under suspicion. But the CPS is there to provide that guidance, that support. The relationship now is very good, in a sense that in fact, a few years ago we went down this policy before I left of actually basing a prosecutor in the police station. to give advice on a sort of daily 24/7 basis. That fell apart a little bit only because of resources. You know, the when police and prosecutors were reducing in numbers as they have done for the last decade, you couldn't justify that anymore. But, you know, the principle of working together as a prosecution team in partnership is one that's now well established.
And there is a big, I talk to obviously lots of lawyers and barristers all the time, and the Law Society and the financial restraints now within the criminal justice system are huge. Do you think that there either is now or there has been a problem with perhaps getting the right or the caliber of lawyers into the Crown Prosecution Service?
I think less so now. It was very, very difficult in the early days, simply because we had no resources. We couldn't pay proper salaries, but now there's no reason why that can't happen. In fact, it's the other way around, Mark. You know, government announced a year or so ago that they would be recruiting more prosecutors, and the defence community were losing their experienced lawyers, so you know, who are now joining the prosecution service. So actually, I think the shortage is now in defence community, where experience has been lost to the CPS, which is now in a position to offer decent salaries, a very good career, and progression internally.
And what about the demands on the Crown Prosecution Service? Because policing is at an all-time high. You look back on the years when, certainly when I was policing, very early days, you know, there were down times. There were times when you literally, you would just be driving around, you know, doing general policing. Nowadays, it's very hard to speak to a police officer who isn't jumping from one job to the other. Now, that is an issue because I think sometimes we policing to the wrong degree. There's obviously so much more paperwork involved, so much more time consumption. But the demands on the Crown Prosecution Service as a direct result of that have surely increased.
Yeah.
Is there a level to which Crown Prosecution Service is keeping up with that? I mean,
no.
You take,
I mean,
for example,
that is a struggle. When I talk to prosecutors who are currently there, they'll tell you, I had 25 serious sex offences on my, you know, in my casework, and now I have 50. And, you know, so they're very, you know, like every agency, people have seen a doubling, or pretty much a doubling of their work. And so that, you know, you can't, you know, it's inhuman to expect people to be able to do twice as much work on various serious cases. I mean, routine volume stuff, no problem at all. You know, shoplifting, that kind of stuff, they should be relatively straightforward to deal with and not use up a lot of time. But some of the cases that we're talking about, and, you know, Carolyn Flack be a good example, requires a lot of time and effort and mind and judgment. And if you only have 45 minutes, 60 minutes, or however much time you think you have, you're going to cut corners.
And one of the things that's a massive problem now, I mean, go back into my early policing days, and we used to prosecute, or we used to investigate and then obviously put files forward for possession of child abuse material. And in the early days, that was a summary only offence, and it had to be, you know, charges had to be laid within 6 months of that case starting. That's obviously all changed now. But one of the things that is a massive problem is the collection of information and evidence. I've got cases that I'm working on across the levels of my work where people have been arrested a year ago and they're still waiting for an outcome in relation to the forensic examinations of their phones and computers. That's horrific, you know, but on two levels. One, obviously you have an individual until they've been to court who is innocent, and so their life is on hold in relation to that. But also some of these offenders, all these individuals who have got material on their computer, it enables them to say, well, I'm going to go to jail anyway. I might as well just carry on. And I think those two elements cause me a real concern.
Well, no, number three, the complainant has to wait.
And the complainant, yeah, of course.
X amount of time before they... I mean, delay is the most biggest problem right now. You know, people can wait 2-3 years for a case to be investigated. They don't have... And particularly around now in the digital world, we don't have enough... digital investigators, prosecutors that have an understanding of this, and it may take years, months, certainly take months, if not years, to properly investigate some serious cases, which is no good to anybody.
And let's just address, I know we've touched on it previously, where is it that the DPP, so the Director of Public Prosecutions, they are the kind of in charge of the Crown Prosecution Service, on what cases will they become involved? And in particular for Caroline Flack's case, you know, is it that the Crown Prosecution Service, the lawyers, would seek guidance or seek clearance from the DPP? Where does that DPP come involved?
I mean, the role of the DPP has changed significantly over the last decade, largely because of the work of Keir Starmer, actually, when and Savile being a good example of that, when he realised, reputationally, everything should cross my desk if it's going to have potential to damage the reputation of the organisation and of justice more generally. So now there are processes in place. So high-profile cases involving an individual should be notified. That's all it is, notification. So the DPP's office will get an email or a report saying Mark Williams Thomas is being investigated for being frozen on camera, whatever the crime might be. And because you are an extremely well-known celebrity, that's the reason why that report will be sent up to the DPP. Now, there are some occasions when the law requires the DPP to be the decision maker.
Yeah.
And they tend to be terrorism, high-profile corruption cases, the cases that require the Attorney General, who technically is a minister, to make a decision. But they are handfuls. We're not talking about large numbers. So the handful of cases which the DPP actually has hands-on decision-making role. The vast majority are of cases, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of cases a year, are dealt with locally. Some of them are notified to the DPP's office, no more, no less. So in Caroline Flack's case, I imagine that the DPP's office would have been sent an email saying she has been charged or they're proposing to charge her for your information, no more, no less.
I mean, I think a very sad case, and of course we don't know the absolute ins and outs of Caroline Flack's death, but I think it's right that we both, pay those respects to Caroline Flack, and it's very sad for her and her family, the outcome that came.
Oh, absolutely. There's no getting away from it. She's not here now. And perhaps if that case had been handled differently, I don't know. We can apply hindsight. But at the very least, had she been given support and care, perhaps more support and care than she did, people hadn't rehearsed everything in public through the media, then maybe she would still be with us. And those are real concerns for us as to why it is that some people are literally tried in the national newspapers rather than being tried appropriately in a courtroom where necessary.
Absolutely. Let's chat about diplomatic immunity. Now, it comes up from time to time. Often we won't hear about it for ages, and then a case just springs up and it brings it back into the forefront of people's mind. And years ago, I can't remember how long ago now, it's got to be at least 10 years ago, I did a program for ITV, which was about the diplomatic immunity. Mm. And what we looked at was how easy was it to transfer items of criminality through the diplomatic bag and through the diplomatic channel. And just to help people understand that, certain countries have diplomatic process whereby they can bring things through what's called the diplomatic bag. In essence, it's just a process where that item or items won't get checked through the process of when they bring it into the country. And we looked at it as to whether or not you could move items through the diplomatic bag. And this undoubtedly is true, because there are cases that have happened over the many years where items have got out of the respective countries through that diplomatic process. The diplomatic immunity is one that not everybody holds, and you have to be in a certain position within an embassy to be able to hold that diplomatic immunity. But if you do hold it, it does offer real safeguards.
Well, it's important that we have that. I mean, the Vienna Convention created this concept and the rules around this, and there's a reason for that. If we have, let's say, we have a diplomat in, I don't know, Botswana. I don't know why Botswana came into my head. But anyway, and the Botswana government or Botswana police don't like him or her and choose to arrest him because he's helping or she's helping some local citizen. There has to be something in place to prevent arbitrary arrest, arbitrary investigation for political reasons, which is in essence why diplomatic immunity was created. It was to give people the ability to do their jobs as diplomats all over the world and afford them some level of protection from arbitrary arrest. And as it said, as you said, it's usually a specified list. So the embassy of I don't know, Zimbabwe, let's come up with a different country, would provide a list of the people who it considers to be diplomats based in London or the UK, and they would be privy to any diplomatic immunity. What happens is there's two options. If we're talking about a crime, diplomatic immunity either affords you the possibility of not being prosecuted, but it doesn't mean that you just hang around. You will also be ejected from the country. So, you know, it's not as if, you know, you can just walk around, you know, with a, you know, sort of like Iron Man and be shot at and walk away unscathed. There are consequences if you are involved in criminal activity, if you're a diplomat. Either you are not prosecuted, but if you're not prosecuted, you are likely to be left to have to leave the country. But I think so. The principle of diplomatic immunity is one that we should celebrate because it enables our diplomats to do their job fairly without threat in other parts of the country. But diplomatic immunity has been known historically to be abused. I've come across cases, you will have as well, where you know, individuals have murdered somebody, for example. And have been able to claim immunity and then go back to their countries without any consequences, potentially.
Let's talk about the Harry Dunn case. So this is a very well-known case that received huge media attention in the UK. On the 27th of August 2019, Harry Dunn died when he was involved in a car collision with a vehicle driven by Anna Skoulas. And Anna Skoulas had been over here. She is a US national. At the time, there was real uproar in relation to what had taken place. Eventually, the Crown Prosecution Service looked at it and decided that there was evidence and that as a result of that, she should be prosecuted. That case is now is ongoing at the moment, the charge in relation to death by dangerous driving. One of the issues that's massively come out of this is the US's position in respect of her, saying that, you know, she isn't going to face trial and she isn't going to come back to the UK to face that. Now, that's something that's ongoing discussions between the Crown Prosecution Service and her US lawyers. But look at this in the broader term, and I think we've got to be really careful because obviously this is an ongoing case.
Yeah, ongoing case. Mm.
But let's look at it in the broader terms in regards to if somebody commits an offence on our territory here and they're allowed to go back to the US, the UK should pursue them, whatever, and the US or whatever country it is should work with us, shouldn't they, under that convention?
Yeah, that again, it's about restoring trust. And you know, there should be very few occasions in which, you know, we're talking about serious cases where somebody has died, or serious cases of rape or whatever. In those cases, there should be, and there is a requirement really for them to either to release that individual from immunity so that they can be prosecuted or investigated, or to return them to this country if they've left the country. And I think the reason for that is that we should do, it's mutual. So we will do the same thing for them. So if a British national diplomat in the United States was involved in some criminal activity, that we would ensure that individual gets justice. And I think it's that mutuality that people forget or people want to ignore. And, you know, in order to maintain confidence in the whole concept of justice and diplomatic immunity as well, people have to play ball. And that, I think, was a bit of a struggle in this case. As I said, we can't talk about the detail because of the outstanding allegation and the potential trial in this case. But there was a significant delay in her being, it was the Americans even acknowledging that she could potentially face a trial in this country. And that really did damage people's confidence in the whole system.
And of course, we have the very high profile case of the murder of Yvonne Fletcher in 1984, when she was shot by a person inside the Libyan embassy. That person, persons, because there were other people involved, were allowed to leave the country under that diplomatic route.
Yeah. And, there have been loads of occasions. I remember, strangest one I remember actually, Mark, was I won't mention the country, an official from a particular country that was being suspected if I say this, you won't be able to identify who it is, of raping a male. It was a male raping a male. And initially, the authorities of that particular country claimed diplomatic immunity for him. And then the particular male diplomat said, "No, please don't. I want to be prosecuted in this country, because if I'm sent home, you will never see me again." So one of those rare occasions where the actual recipient of the immunity didn't want the immunity because of the consequences that might flow from that. So it's much more complex than people think it is. And, you know, there are lots of occasions when it happens. It happens day in, day out, I imagine, Mark. But, you know, you don't hear about it very often.
No, and it only comes up, and obviously we've got the terrible Harry Dunn case, which brings it to the forefront. But the large majority of people who are obviously in this country working under diplomatic immunity are law-abiding citizens. Oh, they don't absolutely do anything wrong.
But they may not pay parking tickets. I think there's a real big issue around that. For those of us who pay parking in London, for example, there are some embassies that owe enormous sums of money in parking tickets and hide behind diplomatic immunity. And but at the end of the day, that's a matter for the government of this country to reach a settlement with the government of the other country. And that, apart from maybe losing a bit of income, it's not really a major consequence, is it?
It's funny you should mention parking tickets. Years ago, I did a review for the NCP, so National Car Parks, and they had a contract to deal with all the congestion charging elements in London. And the outstanding, and I can't even remember how it is, but the outstanding amount of money owed to the congestion charging by the US embassy was phenomenal.
Because
it's huge, absolutely huge. And it's never been paid. And they just simply don't do anything. And obviously it then ends up getting written off. But a horrific amount of money that exists.
Yeah, I think, because the basic principle is that people should be able to do their diplomatic duties without consequences locally, because it has been abused. You know, people have been, I guess, in some parts of the world, been accused of parking in the wrong place, then getting arrested, then finding themselves in a courtroom just as an excuse for a political reason, i.e. this country doesn't like that country. So I think we know that diplomatic immunity has its purpose and has a good reason. It's the abuses of it that we are concerned about. I think the answer to that question, or how we deal with it, Mark, is to always shine a light on it. Transparency, people knowing that there's an issue in relation to diplomatic immunity in some particular case, actually builds confidence rather than detracts from it.
Absolutely. Another issue that our listeners have asked us to talk about, and we address this kind of every week, is the systemic change, looking at the issues of how democracy gets eaten away and how individuals use the system to their benefit and for their cause, whatever that is. And I think one of the things that's massively highlighted this on a world stage is the issue of the minister in Australia and Djokovic, Alex Hawke. I mean, this is a big issue where he's kind of taken on a position and taken on the government. And we see it within the UK government system, where certain ministers will have a bee in their bonnet about something. And it becomes about them rather than about the constituency and the role that they're performing.
Yeah, no, absolutely, 100%. Again, it's important to remember that a minister who makes a decision of the type in Djokovic's case or anywhere else takes their power from their parliament. It's not an arbitrary power. The minister is not saying, right, I am God and I will decide who can come in, who can't come in. They are saying the immigration rules give me, as the Minister for Immigration or whatever home, the power to make this decision. It's subject to legal challenge, and very often it is. But the point is that it gives that power to one individual. And I think the concerns that have been raised by some of our listeners in relation to that particular power, that particular individual, is that it's immensely powerful to be able to decide who can come in, who can't come in. But the point is that governments do this day in, day out. Mm. Right now, where we're, you know, wherever you are, there'll be somebody arriving at an airport and a decision's being made by a border official as to whether they can come in or whether they come out. You just don't hear about it.
No, and I think obviously one of those issues that sits around that is how much responsibility individuals take about the decision-making process. Because if you wanted to abuse the process, and it's the same for police officers, it's the same for anybody in any public role, you can do that if you have the power.
Power corrupts. Yeah, we know that. I think Spider-Man said, with great power comes great responsibility. You know, the important thing, again, is that people... that we have really good lawyers, human rights lawyers, who are able to provide you with advice, that there is transparent application of the law, that it's across the board, that it can't be selective. If you're going to do this to Djokovic, you need to do this to Mark, you need to do this to me or whoever. You know, it needs to be applied equally across the board. And you publish where you're doing it, so you're not doing it in secret and privately. You know, it's about that thing about shining a light on something. That, I think, is the key for pretty much everything that we've talked about. That if things happen in a smoky room behind closed doors, people think, well, people begin to believe conspiracies. People begin to think there's something up.
Absolutely. Something I want to explore in more detail, and there's a guy who's a reporter I actually know, Nick Wallace, who has brilliantly covered this story, is the whole post office situation. And I just want to touch on it with you now. But this is a case that really should have received far greater media attention than it has, in my opinion. But this is a case where post office, sub-post office masters have effectively... over years been prosecuted for theft when no theft's taken place, when senior individuals within the post office have basically used a computer system which they've known has been flawed, yet have brought prosecutions against these people. And it's resulted, sadly, in some of the pressure getting so much for some of these people that they've taken their lives.
I mean, to endorse what you said, I mean, there's a public inquiry going on right now, which is good that it's being done. It is, without a doubt, the biggest miscarriage of justice in this country. We are talking about 700. I don't know the final number.
Yeah, it's about that.
Who've been unfairly prosecuted, many of them going to prison for crimes, not only that they didn't commit, for crimes that didn't even happen. You know, this was a IT system that said money was short. From the till when it wasn't. And these were cases brought by post office prosecutions, so it didn't involve the Crown Prosecution Service. There were lots of lawyers involved, judges, you name it. Everybody failed to understand. And, of course, what this inquiry is about is to try and understand who knew what and when. And the impression that I'm left with, Mark, is that there must have been senior officials at the post office. Senior officials at, I think, Fujitsu are the people behind the Horizon program, which was the software, all of whom need to be brought to book, really, for what they've done. And if they have committed a crime, i.e. they've covered things up, then as of the many have been calling for, they need to be brought to justice for this because they have destroyed hundreds of lives. I mean, as I say, I've dealt with miscarriage of justice when you have one person, maybe 10 suspects, perhaps, or whatever, you know. If you have hundreds of people, all law-abiding, hardworking individuals who have suffered as a result of this, there literally have to be consequences.
There has to be. And we talk about this all the time, about people being held accountable for their roles. No matter what you do, when you are... whether you're at the lowest of the rank or the highest of the rank, we have to be accountable for the roles that we perform. And when you are making decisions that affect people's lives, and let's be very clear, if you are a sub-postmaster and you are being charged with theft, that's your livelihood. That is your life. It is everything. And the impact on you and the impact on your family is immense. And I think we forget, and it's easy to forget because we see it in, you know, in moments when we read an article.
Never for the grace of God go you and I. I mean, literally this machine or this software was happening everywhere and anywhere. And it could suddenly have happened in your post office or your family's post office. And then you end up being locked up in a prison with real criminals. And all of that, I mean, just thinking about their experiences has been, really troubling for me. And additionally, thinking about those who knew about this has been really troubling. There must have come a point, surely, Mark, when, hang on a minute, we've had 100 people prosecuted for this. There can't be 100 thieves in our...
I know. And when did that alarm bell drop?
Exactly.
When did that alarm go off? Because it must have gone off.
At some point, somebody in authority in those institutions must have come to the conclusion that there was something amiss here. There can't have been the massive, serious, organized crime gang of some postmasters here. There was something wrong and something needs to be dealt with. And there needs, as I say, to be consequences for us to restore our faith in the post office and restore our faith in justice.
And of course, very significantly, all brought to the attention as a result of a computer system. It's not as though these are members of the public coming in and saying, actually, I should give you a bit of information. This person's doing this. It's just highlighted as a result
absolutely.
Of a
and
computer
credit,
system.
And a credit, as you said at the outset, to Nick Wallace, to journalism, to people who dedicate themselves to uncovering the truth on behalf of the rest of us. We often criticize the media, and we often criticize journalists. But here's a classic example. We wouldn't know about this. We wouldn't, certainly not sufficiently to have a public inquiry if it wasn't for the work of the journalists who uncovered it all.
No, brilliant. And I think, I'll speak to Nick and perhaps we'll get Nick on air. But this is a result of Nick dedicated. He had to put up a crowdfunding page just to be able to cover the whole of the court case because there just wasn't a media outlet that was giving enough of an input to that. And that is the testimony to an individual who takes his job incredibly seriously as a journalist to bring the truth to people. So, hat off to him. And there are other journalists who have done equally good work around this case.
Yeah, absolutely. I pay tribute to all investigative journalists who are demonstrating. Well, they're filling a gap because, the police won't do it. Other agencies aren't doing it. So somebody needs to do it. And we wouldn't be where we are today knowing how bad this was were it not for their work.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I've got a busy week ahead. I've flat out now into my Diana program and we start edit very soon. And actually, the way tends to work is that we film and edit at the same time simply because, restraints are so tight in terms of budgets and delivery times as well. And you've got a busy week up.
It never stops, but I love it. And, I'm looking forward to our next podcast though.
Brilliant. Well, thank you again for listening. Please do tell your friends about Fear or Favour. Subscribe to our channel. And if you've got something that you want us to talk about or just simply make some comment, please do drop us an email or you can contact us via our Twitter page. I think certainly coming up, we're going to be talking some more in relation to the post office. I'd very much like to get Nick Wallace on here to talk in detail about that. And I think something that you've mentioned previously is the Daniel Morgan case. I think we should cover that because I think that has not just an impact in terms of an unsolved murder, but it goes at the heart of some of the issues around misogyny, around attitudes in policing. This whole thing has, and I think has a big bearing on kind of where the Metropolitan Police is now.
Absolutely. 100%. Let's do that.
Brilliant. Well, thanks for listening and we shall see you all next week. Take care.
Bye now.
Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kays, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.